And welcome to Debate. I'm Marcia Hashemi. Appreciate you being with us. Well, it is not likely that any of the top brass of the Saudi Arabia at the start of their onslaught on Yemen thought that 6.5 years later they would still be fighting. And now it is the Yemeni military, along with Ansarullah fighters, who are now attacking Saudi Arabia. The Yemeni army spokesman announced that Yemen had initiated retaliatory attacks inside of Saudi Arabia on the King Khalid military base in Aser. Stay with us as we take a look at how the tables have turned on the Saudi regime.
The Yemeni army has carried out another successful massive operation that was announced by the spokesman for the Yemeni army, Yahya Saria, who described the offensive as a major victory in the southern Saudi Jazan region.
There is no doubt that this operation will affect the Saudi enemy severely, especially as it comes at a time when the Marib fronts and other fronts are under much pressure. Thus, these back-to-back victories confirm Saudi Arabia's inability to achieve any of the goals declared at the beginning of the war. The Saudi-led coalition failed in the military confrontation, while the Yemeni army continued to significantly improve its capabilities.
The spokesman stated that this operation comes in response to the escalation of Saudi Arabia's war and its ongoing siege on Yemen. Military experts said this victory could be part of the ongoing talks, as it will push Riyadh further to accept a fair political solution.
Every military operation, including the Jizan operation, has political dimensions. Saudi Arabia is an arrogant country that believes its capabilities and the support it receives by Britain and America will help it achieve something in the field. Today, the Yemeni army proved that it is capable of gaining military control and that the battle has moved deep inside Saudi soil. Saudi Arabia is forced to move forward a political solution, but militarily it has completely failed.
Earlier, Yemen's armed forces carried out a retaliatory attack against the King Khalid Air Base in Azir using Qassam K2 drones. The Saudi war has brought about the world's worst humanitarian crisis in Yemen, according to the United Nations.
Observers say the ongoing operation by the Yemeni army has sent a clear message to Saudi Arabia. That is, as long as the Saudi war and siege against Yemen is persist, Yemen's army will carry out more massive retaliatory attacks deep inside the kingdom. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
I'd like to welcome my guest to this program, Director of Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, Zafar Bangash, out of Toronto, and Elijah Macmillan, journalist and political analyst out of Brussels. Thank you both for being with us. Let's start it off in Toronto. And Zafar, how could the Saudis have miscalculated Yemen this much? I mean, they thought the war would not take more than a month or two. Your assessment?
Well, basically, the Saudi defense minister, who is now also the crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman, when he was first appointed, he was full of arrogance. He thought that the Saudi army, because it is equipped with a lot of weapons, would be able to wipe out any Yemeni resistance. But what he did not realize was, number one, that the Saudi army is not motivated. In fact, they are not really capable of fighting. Number two, they underestimated the Yemenis' resistance. The point is that the Yemenis are fighting for their land, for their honor, for their principle. What the Saudis are doing is they are the aggressors. They want to occupy somebody else's land, and they want to install a puppet regime in Yemen. Obviously, that is not acceptable to the Yemeni people. Secondly, the Saudis counted on a number of mercenaries. In fact, they approached a number of countries, including countries like Pakistan and Egypt and so on, hoping that they would send their armed forces to support the Saudis, and these countries refused. So the Saudis had to resort to mercenaries from South America, from Africa, from Sudan, etc. But naturally, even these mercenaries cannot continue to wage a war on behalf of the Saudis. So as you mentioned, it's been more than 6 years, and I think the Saudi army and their soldiers, etc., have realized that this is a lost cause, and the best thing is not to put up a fight, and in fact, many of them are surrendering.
Well, Elijah, the Saudis initiated a ruthless onslaught on Yemen back in 2015, bombing civilian areas and infrastructure, and also implementing a land, air, and sea siege of the area. I mean, what was Riyadh really trying to accomplish with this type of violence against the civilian population in Yemen?
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming.
There are 2 points. First of all, Saudis are trying to submit Yemen to its control because Yemen is considered its backyard. And secondly, they are afraid of the influence of Iran in Yemen. This is what the Saudis tried, started the war, thinking that it is a promenade and thinking that in a matter of weeks this will end. It has been 6 years, and during these 6 years, the Yemeni learned how to make their own bombs, have learned the art of war, and they have also learned how to retaliate. And what we have seen very recently in the last 24 hours, how the Yemeni are taking the initiative and attacking Jazan and making really strong progress. Now, what Saudi Arabia is doing is really destroying Yemen. The cost of war so far is estimated around $100 billion. And the only thing that Saudis have achieved so far is the destruction of the country, where there is the largest humanitarian crisis ever against the poorest country in the Middle East. We saw the Yemenis are learning how to fight back, how to make missiles, and how to do their own drones and armed drones, and how to retaliate and hurt Saudi Arabia. And I think now the Saudis are trying to find a way out, but they want to gain in negotiation what they failed to gain in the war.
Okay.
Therefore, the Houthis... Yes, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, let me just get Zafar back in on this discussion. Well, although the Yemenis have been under a Saudi siege, Yemeni fighters and Houthis have continually improved, so much so that they are now attacking Saudi Arabia. What do you attribute this to? I mean, how are they able to do this despite the siege?
Well, I think we need to keep in mind that the Yemenis are one people that have never, ever surrendered to foreign forces. That goes to their credit. Secondly, as your guest pointed out, the Yemenis have been able to make immense progress in terms of developing their military capabilities. Yemen already had actually a missile industry before the Saudis launched a war against them, but it was not as advanced as it has come now. And thirdly, the Saudi army, that is, they're not only totally incompetent, they're also demoralized. So what the Yemenis have been able to do is, because of their determination, because of the fact that their cause is just, they are fighting to defend their own land. They're not committing aggression. In fact, even the operations that they are carrying out inside Saudi Arabia in provinces like Jizan and Asir, these actually belong to the Yemeni people. These were illegally occupied by the Saudis in 1934. So perhaps this Saudi aggression against Yemen that was launched in March of 2015 may turn out to be a blessing in disguise for the Yemenis, despite the enormous sacrifices that they have had to make, but that they perhaps might be able to reclaim the land that the Saudis had illegally occupied back in 1934. So their cause is just, they are highly motivated, they are excellent fighters, they have never surrendered to any foreign forces. All of these factors actually go in favor of the Yemeni people. Mm.
Okay. Well, Elijah, I mean, how significant in your perspective that we've seen the Yemeni forces just attacking a military base by drone inside of Saudi Arabia, and we've seen other retaliatory attacks and dealing with oil tankers. How disruptive has this been?
I think that had significant effect on Saudi Arabia economy, reputation, and finance. We saw how the Yemeni were able to disrupt the oil flow from Saudi Arabia to the rest of the world for several days and or even for a couple of weeks. And we saw how the Yemeni were able to hit inland in Saudi Arabia and to give back the same amount of, not the same amount, but to retaliate in Saudi Arabia in different area, even going toward far in Saudi Arabia, so 1,200 kilometers. saw how the Yemeni were capable to force the Saudis to the negotiation table. Unfortunately, the Americans are negotiating on behalf of the Saudis now in Sana'a, and not the Saudis, because they don't have the skills or the courage to negotiate.
Well, what about that, Zafar? Eliyah talked about the Americans negotiating on behalf of the Saudis. Your perspective on the United States, do you think that at this point in time that they want this war to end? Are you detecting some type of changing perspective coming out of Washington? Are your assessment overall?
Well, the Americans are actually trying to change the perception, but not their policy. So while Biden and his regime continues to talk about not providing offensive weapons to the Saudis, but we have seen no evidence that they have stopped supplying weapons to the Saudis, or that they are still providing logistical and intelligence support to the Saudis. So these negotiations that are taking place under the UN auspices regarding Yemen, obviously, as Eliyah pointed out, these are basically guided by the Americans, because America virtually controls the United Nations, and so it is actually dictating the agenda. But what is important and crucial for your viewers to understand is that the Yemenis, throughout this war on them, have maintained the high moral ground. The Saudis have been attacking civilian infrastructure. The Yemeni Ansarullah fighters have not attacked any civilian infrastructure. They have targeted military installations. They have targeted economic installations. There was only one instance, in fact, when the Yemenis fired a missile at a palace in which they thought the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman was staying. So throughout these 6+ years, the Yemenis have only targeted military installations because they do not believe in inflicting civilian casualties, although they can. So on these counts, I think the Yemenis really maintain the high moral ground, and they are fully justified in not accepting any demands that the Americans make of them.
Well, Eliyah, what about Riyadh itself? Do you think it is looking for a way to end this war now?
Riyadh is really willing to come out of this problem that Saudi Arabia put itself in, and we cannot exclude the meeting, the couple of meetings that happened between Saudi Arabia and Iran in Baghdad, where the Saudis on the top of their agenda was the situation in Yemen. And we saw how Minister Zarif went to Muscat, Salam, to slow down on the base that the Saudis will lift the siege. And the Yemeni made it very clear, we cannot stop the war on our side because the Houthis are now dictating the battle. They say we cannot stop the war on our side unless you lift the siege, and we will not accept an exchange of ceasefire in exchange of humanitarian aid. You allow us to survive, you allow us to live. We want the 16 ships that are full of oil. There is no oil in Yemen today, and we want all the aids before we start talking about a ceasefire. Today, Saudi Arabia is trembling of the idea that the Houthis are going to liberate Maghreb, and this is going to happen very soon. And I think they will liberate Maghreb and get their oil rich in any ceasefire.
Okay. Well, Zafar, there seems to be a unique strength and determination in the Yemeni people. I mean, what is it that makes them so determined, although the Saudi regime is killing civilians on a regular basis, as well as destroying the infrastructure, restricting basic necessities, and at least 16 million Yemenis are estimated to be food insecure out of a population of 29 million, and they have refused to surrender to the Saudi regime. And you touch on this a bit, but I'd like for you to expand on it.
Sure. Basically, as I mentioned, the Yemeni people are absolutely brilliant fighters. There are very few other people in the world, perhaps I might even mention the Afghans, who have defeated now the third superpower of their time. But the Yemenis are absolutely determined fighters. But what is also very crucial to keep in mind is that the Yemenis don't rely only on weapons, they rely on their faith. They have a firm conviction in God's help. They are very, very determined people. They are very pious people. As I mentioned, they have not targeted civilians in Saudi Arabia, although they are quite capable of doing it, which shows that they have maintained the high moral ground. They have maintained their dignity and their honor in the face of all of these extremely difficult conditions that have been imposed upon them. I mean, you know, a country that is under total siege, they cannot get food in, they cannot get oil in, and you know, millions of people are starving. More than a million children are afflicted by cholera epidemic. I mean, this is absolutely unheard of in recent history. And yet, the Yemenis have maintained their dignity and honor because they have such strong commitment to Allah and to Islam, mm-hmm. and they want to maintain that, and that is the reason why they have been successful. And I think we should take heart from this fact that whenever Muslims, regardless of where they are, for instance, you can look at the situation in Palestine, in Gaza, again, the commitment of the people of Palestine and their firm commitment to Allah has provided them these opportunities. So I think this is a very important lesson for Muslims worldwide,
okay.
that instead of relying on weapons, they can rely on the help of Allah and remain steadfast.
Well, what about that, Elijah? You heard Zafar, he talked about Palestine. I want to look at this because something else unique about the Yemenis, at the despite all of the hardships that we've just mentioned, some of them, they've recently been raising money for the Palestinians after the situation that took place 11 days onslaught, Israeli onslaught on Gaza. They have been busy raising money and giving support to the Palestinian cause despite them being under such pressure. Now, both of these groups, it's interesting, if we look at the similarities of what's happening in Gaza and what's happening in Yemen, both under siege, and the resistance despite this pressure both being effective. Your take on this?
This is a very important question. Apart from the touchy move of the Yemeni, who are really starving and have very little asset, they managed to put together over $200,000. I mean, look at the amount they managed to put together to send it to Gaza and to support the Palestinian population. This gest is very significant, but the most significant, we see how the axis of the resistance that goes from Yemen to Tehran, to Baghdad, to Syria, Damascus, and to Lebanon, and to end in Gaza, how it is all compact and it's holding together. When Yemen came out and said, we are waiting for Gaza to tell us if they need us to fight and to support them, this is extremely significant, because that is the work of all these years, to bring out a line of population ready to fight against the aggressor, whoever they are, wherever they are, whoever they are, because even if they are very strong, the people of Yemen express their solidarity with Gaza to tell them that you are not alone and this whole front is here to support you. The creation of this front is the most significant issue in all of this.
Zafar, your take on this resistance front and being in solidarity now, of course, had been before, but definitely seeming to be even more effective than it has been. Your assessment?
Absolutely. In fact, as we see these developments take hold, the resistance front is gaining more and more strength. And this clearly indicates that the resistance front, which obviously the Islamic Republic of Iran is a major component of, has been motivated to a level whereby these resistance fighters are not guided by any worldly considerations, but in fact they are determined to uphold truth and justice, whether it is in Yemen, in Gaza, in Lebanon, in the rest of Palestine, in Iraq, where they are facing this American occupation, or in Syria, which again is has been subjected to the horrendous mercenary onslaught from all over the world, and of course with the American forces over there. But the fact that the Islamic Republic was upfront in supporting Syria, because Syria is a very, very important component for the resistance front in order to be able to provide material support to Hezbollah in Lebanon, as well as material support to the people of Gaza. So we see that the resistance front is actually operating on very high moral principles and upholding justice and fairness. And I think any people that stand up for truth and justice and show solidarity, I think ultimately they will triumph.
And Elijah, your take, now that not only the resistance front, but we look at Yemen itself, the military and Ansar Allah, the Houthis are getting stronger by the day. Do you see a light at the end of the tunnel as far as this war? Do you think that we're heading towards the end of the Saudi onslaught on Yemen?
Actually, I do, because today we see the axis of the resistance coming together, but we also see another element wherever there is an attack against one member of the axis of the resistance. The operational theater can be anywhere in these countries, and we're talking about Yemen, Iraq, Lebanon, Syria, and Gaza. And this solidarity is forcing the other side, who is fighting in these countries, particularly the United States, to stop this war, to try to do something to stop this solidarity that is already made, and nothing can stop it. Therefore, I think the Saudis are really seriously going toward the ceasefire, because they have lost the battle and they want to end it, come out with the less damage possible. Therefore, the negotiation that is happening in Muscat today, the Americans are trying to gain some ground, and the Houthis are very firm, and they will continue to do so. And I think it is an advantage of the Saudis and the Americans to end this war, and I think this is going to happen most probably this year.
All right, and on that note, appreciate both of you being with us for this debate. Zafar Bankash, Director of Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought out of Toronto, and Elijah Mackier, journalist and political analyst out of Brussels. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, Dear brothers and sisters, I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll be discussing the commentary of the 23rd chapter of the Holy Quran, Surah Al-Mu'minun, or the Believers. Now let's just listen to the related verses, and then we'll be back, so stay with us.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
فأوحينا إليه أن اصنع الفلك بأعيننا ووحينا فإذا
So we inspired to him, construct the ship under our observation and our inspiration. And when our command comes and the oven overflows, put into the ship from each creature two mates and your family, except those for whom the decree of destruction has proceeded. And do not address me concerning those who have wronged. Indeed, they are to be drowned.
Brothers and sisters, we were talking about the 27th verse of the chapter, Chapter Mu'minun. فَأُحَيْنَا إِلَيْهِ أَنِسْنَعِ الْفُلْكَ بِأَعْيُنِنَا وَوَحِيِنَا. We revealed unto him, build the ark before our eyes and according to our revelation. فَإِذَا جَاءَ أَمْرُنَا وَفَارَتَ النُّورُ فَاسْلُكْ فِيهَا مِنْ كُلِّ زَوْجَيْنِ اثْنَيْنِ وَأَهْلَكَ. Then, when our command comes and the oven gushes water, take into it a pair of every kind and also your family. إِلَّا مَنْ سَبَقَ عَلَيْهِ الْقَوْلُ مِنْهُمْ. Except those of them against whom the word has already gone. وَلَا تُخَاطِبْنِي فِي الَّذِينَ ظَلَمُوا. And plead not with me on behalf of those who are unjust. إِنَّهُمْ مُغْرَقُونَ. Verily, they shall be drowned. So, this wahy of the Almighty Allah, the revelation was sent down unto the Prophet when he called unto his Lord and said, رَبِّنْ سُرْنِي بِمَا كَذَّبُونَ. Help me against what they belie. So based on the revelations, he tried to build the ark, and this was the divine revelation. And he called out unto his Lord, the Almighty Allah answered to him. At the same time, he was supplicating and calling out unto his Lord. He did not stop doing what he was supposed to do, and he tried to do his actions based on the revelation. Now, by the Almighty Allah's will, water was gushed forth from the oven full of fire. And maybe this gushing of water from this oven is showing the time the accident actually happened. Now, he was supposed not to let the extinction of the animals happen. So, he was ordered by the Almighty Allah to take into the arch every pair of every kind of animal. Then he's allowed to have his family with him, except those of them that the word has already gone forth. So, even from among the families of the prophets, even the children of the prophets, if they are from among the wrongdoers, they will not be close to the Almighty Allah's mercy. Now, for these people, the Almighty Allah says, "La tukhatibni fil ladina zalamu." The ones who are not believers, they are unjust, and you are not supposed to plead with me on behalf of those. Interventions sometimes are not the right way. The interventions on behalf of the others have to be made by the Almighty Allah's will.
So we inspired to him, "Construct the ship under our observation and our inspiration. And when our command comes and the oven overflows, put into the ship from each creature two mates and your family, except those for whom the decree of destruction has proceeded. And do not address me concerning those who have wronged. Indeed, they are to be drowned."
The verse introduces, "وَلَا تُخَاطِبْنِي فِي الَّذِينَ ظَلَمُوا." And plead not with me on behalf of those who are unjust, proving that the ones who are polytheists, they are actually unjust, both to themselves and the others. And the interesting point regarding the verse is that says, "Innahum mughraqun," they will be drowned for sure. The point is, dear listeners, that this water that is the elixir of life will be the origin of destruction and annihilation of the people. And the reason why these people are called Mughraqun and from among the ones who are going to be drowned is that they were unjust. So polytheism is the reason to be unjust, and being unjust is the reason to be perished, to be destroyed. And not only destroyed in this world, but also losing the afterworld and hereafter as well. Anyway, one question remains to be answered with regard to this verse, and it is why the Almighty Allah is telling his prophet not to plead with him. Of course, this warning was because the prophet could have been moved by the human sentiments or maybe fatherly affection that might lead him to intercede on behalf of them. But as we said earlier, intercession has its conditions, and he was not to intercede on behalf of them because they no longer deserved intercession. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind. this life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me. Why ends when fate begins?
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parsetoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to Heavenly Grief. We would like to send our condolences to all the Shias around the world, and may Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala accept your griefs and sorrow, for these are the days of the anniversary of the martyrdom of our sixth Imam, Imam al-Sadiq, ruhi lahu al-fida. So I am your host, Habib Zatar, with you today, and with me is Sayyid Ali Musawi al-Jazairi. Sayyidina, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you for coming.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, my dear brother Habib. I'm so glad and happy to be with you in this program.
Very happy to be with you, my brother, as well, in the remembrance of our Imam, Imam al-Sadiq. So, brothers and sisters, we wanted to talk about Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. And before that, we were introducing something. We were giving an introduction. And we were stating that we should look at the lives of the Imam as one single person, a man who lived for 250 years. And we also stated that there was one significant goal that all of the Imam alayhim as-salam shared, and that was, you could say that ruling the people should be by a person who is was given right by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the person who created us, the person who knows how to heal, you could say heal, our spiritual and political problems. And that is only available in the Prophet and his household. And that is why they tried to introduce this idea, to emphasize on this idea to the people and companions of their time. Now, unfortunately, we stopped you right there, and we're very sorry for that, but our time finished, and we would like you to continue, our dear sir.
Thank you very much, my brother Habib. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Allahumma salli ala Sayyidina Muhammadin wa alihi al-Tahirin. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, dear brothers and sisters across the world. I hope that you are keeping well and doing well. And I have to offer my condolences, firstly, to the Imam of our time, and secondly, to you, dear followers of Ahlul Bayt. May God's peace and blessings be upon all of them. Thank you very much, my brother Habib, for summarizing the things that we shared with our brothers and sisters last session. It was a good summary that you offered and delivered. Okay, we said that the position of the spiritual leadership and directing is not separable from the position of the scientific leadership, and both are not separable from the position of the political and social leadership.
No to segregation.
Yes, of course. But the significant point that I want to put the finger of emphasis on as a conclusion that we are able to draw out of this precious and important introduction is that, considering the inseparability of the position of the social and political leadership and authority from the position of authority in religious sciences and in spirituality, we can come to this conclusion that if it had been proved for one of our a'immah that it was the most knowledgeable jurist of his own time, that he was the most authoritative resource of religious sciences, and he was the most spiritual and pious person and individual in his own time, it would have been proved that he is the most deserving person for the political and social leadership and authority as well. This is the conclusion that we are able to draw out of that introduction. Therefore, it's totally reasonable and logical that one of the aspects, one of the most prominent and significant aspects of the life of our A'immah would be this unceasing struggle to prove this fact that they are the ones who are the most knowledgeable people, are the most pious and the most spiritual people within the society, in order to come to this conclusion that they are the ones who are deserving the political and social leadership as well. It's for this very fact that the Umayyad and Abbasid caliphs always were afraid of this dignity and position and grandeur of our A'immah within the eyes of the people. They were afraid of their scientific and spiritual position within the eyes of the people, and they actually exerted any possible efforts in order to humiliate and belittle our A'immah in front of the public, in front of their companions, and even in front of the actually scholars of their own time.
I think this answers the question for many that claim and state and just wonder and ponder, why would the triumph rulers be so harsh to the A'immah alayhi wasalam?
Yes, of course.
Why are they afraid of them?
Yes.
And I think that goes back to them really being in that status of knowledge, being in that status of capability of ruling, actually.
You see, according to this perspective, and throughout this perspective, we are able to analyze these actually oppressions and aggressions against our A'immah within their lifetimes. Yes? Because there was a rule and regulation first. What was that rule? Inseparability
between religion and states.
And states. This was the rule. And what was the instance of rule? Our A'immah. We are the ones who are the most knowledgeable and the most spiritual. So we are deserving the position of political and social because of this matter. They always were afraid. Other scholars, they didn't have their eyes
on ruling.
The ruling. You see? Because of that, it happened. But let us come to the point and to the life of Al-Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam. You see, the struggles for power between Umayyad and Abbasid that were taking place within the lifetime of Al-Imam al-Sadiq offered him a suitable opportunity to embark upon a program of teaching and reform. So we can say that the scientific movement of Shia emerged in the age of Al-Imam al-Sadiq. May God peace and blessings be upon him.
Thank you very much, Sayyidina. We have to go and take a short break. So brothers and sisters, please stay tuned to Heavenly Grief. And we would like to send our condolences to all the Shia around the world, for these are the days of the anniversary of the martyrdom of our sixth Imam, Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salatu wassalam. So please tune back in. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you guys for tuning back in. We would like to send our condolences to all the Shias around the world, for these are the days of the anniversary of the martyrdom of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. And with me today is Sayyid Ali Musawi. And Sayyidina, we were talking about the lives of the A'immah alayhi salam in a whole, as like one person who lived 250 years, and that there's no segregation in Islam, and really the rightful thing to do is to not separate state from religion. Why? Because human beings are spiritual creations. And we reached to a point where we stated that by the A'immah alayhi salam, how do they show that they are righteously the Khalifa, or righteously the people who should be sitting on the throne or ruling? And that is by showing their knowledge, their spiritual aspects. And because of that, because they rightly are in that way, the triumph rulers of the time were closing on them.
Yes,
and
course.
I think we reached to a point where we were stating that Imam Sadiq alayhi salam was a little bit different.
Yes, of course.
Why? Because it was the end of one rulership and the beginning of another.
Yes.
And we stopped you there.
Thank you very much. Yes, we started talking about this scientific movement and struggle that got started with Al-Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam, because there were struggles for power between Umayyad and Abbasid, and so he had a good opportunity to hold some classes.
What made it so good? What's so significant about the Abbasids and the Umayyads fighting over? At the end of the day, the Abbasids also had a tight lock on the Imam alayhi salam.
Yes, of course.
So what's so significant about the stage?
They actually, all of their powers, their attention were focused on the matter of rulership and power. So Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam got a good opportunity to hold some classes, to speak, to communicate with people. But Imam al-Sadiq himself was killed by Mansur al-Dawanid, the second Abbasid caliph. Okay.
So they let down their guard at that time, the Abbasid caliphs.
Yes, of course. It was like this. Multiple outstanding scholars were educated and cultured and instructed under Al-Imam al-Sadiq's hand in the way that none of our A'immah had as many students as Al-Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam had.
Why wasn't, for example, Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, or for example, Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein, why weren't they in this manner, that they didn't have a lot of companions? And what I personally view, when I look at the sayings, most of our sayings come from Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam.
Yes, of course.
And does the different dynasties, the Umayyad dynasty and the Abbasid Caliphate, play a role in this? Because I think the Umayyads, I think they're the ones that closed the door for narrations, writing down narrations
and so on.
Of course.
You are talking about the companions and the students of, for example, Al-Imam al-Mujtaba, Al-Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Let me say that from, for example, Al-Imam al-Hussein, there are less than 100 narrations, only 100 narrations from Al-Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam.
It's very unfortunate.
Al-Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam himself only had 4,000 students. You see the difference between these two occasions. Al-Shaykh al-Mufid, regarding the number of his students, writes, فَإِنَّ أَصْحَابَ الْحَدِيثِ قَدْ جَمَعُوا أَسْمَاعَ الرُّوَاتِ عَنْهُ مِنَ الثِّقَاتِ عَلَى اخْتِلَافِهِمْ فِي الْآرَاءِ وَالْمَقَالَاتِ فَكَانُوا 4,000 رَجُلٍ. This is the statement of Al-Shaykh al-Mufid. He says, the traditionalists have collected the name of the reliable traditionist with different opinions and thoughts who have narrated from him, from Al-Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam. They are 4,000 men. More than half of Shia narrators from our A'immah, whose names are reflected in the two books of Al-Fihrist wal-Rijal, authored by Al-Shaykh al-Tusi, are students of Al-Imam al-Sadiq. 6,429 is the number of the whole Shia narrators in these two books, while 3,238 of them are Al-Imam al-Sadiq's students. The amazing point is that 12 of them are females. 12 Shia narrators from Al-Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam are females and women. Muhammad Sadiq Nashat, the teacher of the University of Qahira, writes, Al-Imam al-Sadiq's house was like a great university that was brimming with great sages and wise men and the people of knowledge. He answered their questions and resolved their scientific problems regardless of their sects, denominations, and their objectives. Hassan ibn Ali al-Washa, one of the companions of Al-Imam al-Ridha, may God's peace and blessings be upon him, the grandson of Al-Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam, says, أدركت في هذا المسجد يعني مسجد الكوفة 900 شيخ كل يقول حدثني جعفر بن محمد. In the mosque of Kufa, I saw 900 elderly scholars, 900 masters who said, Ja'far, the son of Muhammad, told me. There are lots of actually information like these, but let me go to a narration that I prepared for you to actually will be able to end this program with this nice narration, so I actually pass some of my information here. Okay, I want to bring up a narration which illustrates the grandeur and majesty of the scientific position of Al-Imam al-Sadiq, even within the eyes of those who considered themselves as his opponents in the field of knowledge. Some narrations that relate his actually scientific
superiority over all scholars within his time and span. You know, An-Nu'man ibn Thabit, or Abu Hanifa, is the famous Kufi jurist and theologian. He is the founder of Hanafi, actually, School of Thought, which is one of the four, actually, denominations of Ahlus Sunnah. He is so praised, admired, and respected by Ahlus Sunnah, so he is called by them Al-Imam Al-A'zam, or Siraj Al-A'imma, the greatest Imam, the light of Imams. He resided in the city of Kufa, while Al-Imam Al-Sadiq alayhi salam resided in the holy city of Medina. And before he meet Al-Imam Al-Sadiq, he actually considered himself as the most knowledgeable scholar within the Islamic world, and even more knowledgeable than Al-Imam Al-Sadiq alayhi salam. Al-Shaykh Al-Saduq narrates this tradition. In a meeting, a young man came to Abu Hanifa and requested him to deliver his legal opinion about something, about a specific matter, to deliver his fatwa. And he answered him. Abu Hanifa delivered his fatwa and legal opinion about that specific matter. Then one of the scholars of Kufa who was present in that meeting approached Abu Hanifa and said to him, Ya Abu Hanifa, إني كنت العام حاجا وذهبت إلى أبي عبد الله مسلما عليه فوجدت هذا الغلام يستفتيه في هذه المسألة بعينها فأفتاه بخلاف ما أفتيته يا أبا حنيفة. This year I went on a pilgrimage to perform Hajj, so I went to Al-Imam Al-Sadiq, and the very young man was there, and he asked him the very question, but he answered him exactly in contrast with what you said. فقال أبو حنيفة وما يعلم جعفر بن محمد أنا أعلم من. Abu Hanifa replied that, what does Ja'far ibn Muhammad know? I am more knowledgeable than him. I know more than him and better than him. أنا لقيت الرجال وسمعتهم وجعفر بن محمد صحفي أخذ العلم من الكتب. I've met great teachers and masters and instructors, and I exerted much efforts and attempts in order to take part in their lessons and hear from them. But Ja'far, the son of Muhammad, only has studied books and gained his knowledge through books. This narration goes on to this point, that this Kufi scholar says, in the next year, I traveled to Mecca to perform Hajj one more time, so I went to Al-Imam Al-Sadiq, may God's peace and blessings be upon him. فَحَكَيْتُ لَهُ الْكَلَامُ فَضَّحِكَتْ ثُمَّ قَالُ. I narrated for him what Abu Hanifa had said, that Imam Al-Sadiq alayhi salam started laughing. And he said, أَمَّا قَوْلُهُ إِنِّي رَجُلٌ صَحَفِيٌّ فَقَدْ صَدَقْ قَرَأْتُ فِي صُحُفِ آبَائِ إِبْرَاهِيمَ وَمُوسَى. He's correct in his statement that I am the one who has gained his knowledge through books. I learned my knowledge through the books of my fathers, Ibrahim and Musa. In my analysis, in this statement of Al-Imam Al-Sadiq alayhi salam, there is a hint that my knowledge belongs to a totally extraordinary realm, prophetic realm, which ordinary people doesn't have any access to. This Kufi scholar continues saying, in the same meeting, Abu Hanifa came in the meeting and took part in the meeting. I don't want to go over the details that took place in that visit and meeting, but a brief perspective over the things that occurred in this meeting is that Al-Imam Al-Sadiq alayhi salam asked Abu Hanifa 7 questions, 3 questions regarding the interpretation of 3 ayat of the Holy Quran and 4 jurisprudential questions. But Abu Hanifa was not able to answer any of these 7 questions. In the 5 first questions, he only kept silent. In the 6th question, he said, Wallahi ma indi fiha shay. I swear by God that I don't know the answer of this question. In the 7th question, he said, Ju'altu fidak, la wallah, ma indi fiha shay. Addressing Al-Imam Al-Sadiq alayhi salam, he said, may I be sacrificed for you. I don't know the answer of this question as well. This narration ends in this way, فَقَامَ وَقَبَّلَ رَأْسَ الصَّادِقِ عَلَيْهِ السَّلَامُ وَخَرَجَ وَهُوَ يَقُولُ إِنَّهُ أَعْلَمُ النَّاسِ. He stood and kissed the head of Al-Imam Al-Sadiq, and he went out of the meeting, repeating this sentence, Indeed, he's the most knowledgeable of the people. Indeed, he's the most knowledgeable of the people. Indeed, he's the most knowledgeable of the people.
Thank you very much, Sayyid. Beautiful, beautiful words. I would like to thank the Sayyid for his research. We benefit very, very much. So, brothers and sisters, may Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala accept your grief and sorrow. And please do not forget us from your prayers. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Answering your doubts and questions, and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah, who is Ar-Rahman? Allah, who is Al-Mannan? La ilaha illallah.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Assalamu alaikum and welcome to Q&A on Islamic Beliefs, broadcasting from IRIB English Radio. This is your host, Haider Al-Bahadli, and today we have our dear esteemed guest, Sayyid Muhsin Naqawi. Sayyid, salamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Sayyid, previously we were talking about the change and the corruption of the Bible, that it has been changed, that it is no longer the Bible that was sent down with Jesus, alayhi salam. And you mentioned one proof that the Bible consists of many books, not chapters like the Quran, 114 chapters, but many books. And that is a proof that there is no longer one book. Which one is the right one? Why are there so many? There are so many different books. And you also mentioned that the Prophet Yusuf alayhi salam, Joseph, is mentioned as a guy who has lost and things that shouldn't be mentioned about a prophet or in a divine book. Please elaborate, Sayyid.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, today I want to start with the statement of a British biblical scholar, John K. Riches, who wrote that the biblical texts were produced over a period in which the living conditions of the writers, political, cultural, economic, and ecological, varied enormously. There are texts which reflect a nomadic existence, texts from people with an established monarchy and temple cult, texts from exile, texts born out of fierce oppression by foreign rulers, courtly texts, texts from wandering charismatic preachers, texts from those who give themselves the airs of sophisticated Hellenistic writers. So it continues, like he's describing this all, and he is talking about the different temples, like how and when they wrote this. So this thing is not being said by me. It's K. Riches, John K. Riches, who wrote this, and he's a scholar in the British biblical. He's a British biblical scholar, and it's his statement. Now, what does it show is, it shows that there is many changes, obviously, according to his statement. So we don't need any proof for this, because they themselves knows that each book which is there is different from the other one. That's the first thing. The second thing is Islamic, you know, I'm talking logically. Logically, when we talk about the, when we compare Quran and the Bible or the Old or New Testament, Quran was written at the time of the Prophet in his life. This is for sure. Because when the revelation was there, Prophet used to call one of his companions and they used to write it. So the actual Quran was written at the time of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, and after him, those written Qurans were gathered and arranged according to the arrangement which Prophet has said. This is about Quran. Now, after that, we don't see any change in the wordings of the Quran. This is what everyone knows and they know. There is no doubt in it. Okay. About the Bible, why it is said it's been changed and it's not the same Bible, it's because Bible was written around 300 to 400 years, or maybe like 50, 60 years after, if we take